Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. China has condemned North Korea's latest launch of an intercontinental ballistic missile, joining criticism by the United States and South Korea. China's foreign ministry said in a statement Saturday that the launch defied UN Security Council resolutions and the common wish of the international community. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said North Korea's latest launch was blatant in violation of multiple United States Security Council resolutions. The top diplomat added that as a principal economic enabler of North Korea's nuclear weapon and ballistic missile development program, China and Russia bear unique and special responsibility. South Korea's defense minister, Song Young-mu, speaks through an interpreter.
North Korea's ballistic missile launch is a serious, provocative act that clearly violates the UN Security Council resolutions multiple times and threatens security and peace on the Korean Peninsula. In particular, even though our government has proposed holding military talks, North Korea went ahead with its missile provocation.
The White House chief of staff has been replaced with a retired Marine Corps general who has been running the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Reince Priebus had been increasingly sidelined in recent weeks by President Donald Trump. In speaking to reporters Friday, the press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, said the conversations about this started about 2 weeks ago. Still, University of Akron political science professor David Cohen says this is unusual.
Reince Priebus, save for the chiefs of staff that closed out administrations, Reince Priebus is by far the shortest serving chief of staff in our nation's history.
This is VOA News. U.S. President Donald Trump's choice for White House chief of staff, retired Marine General John Kelly, was one of the military's longest-serving commanders before Mr. Trump named him Secretary for the Department of Homeland Security. The 67-year-old Kelly is known for his blunt-spoken style and is popular with military personnel. Mr. Trump described him in a tweet Friday as a great American and a great leader. Kelly has worked to carry out Trump's election promises, including plans to build a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border, deport undocumented immigrants, and tighten visa screening efforts to thwart potential terrorists. The White House says President Trump's approval of Congress comes with new sanctions against Russia, and he intends to sign a bill. In a statement Friday, the press secretary said the president has reviewed the final version of the bill that outlines additional sanctions against a wide range of Russia industries. The bill also gives Congress the ability to block the president from lifting the Russia sanctions, since the Trump administration had to oppose the sanctions aimed at punishing Russia for allegedly interfering in last year's U.S. presidential elections. Against the backdrop of the site where 15 members of the notorious MS-13 gang were arrested for murder last week in Suffolk County on New York's Long Island, President Trump Friday promised to liberate towns from gangs. Speaking to a group of law enforcement officers, Mr. Trump called on Congress to approve funds for an additional 10,000 Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers, or ICE, in order to root out the criminal cartels.
MS-13 gang members have brutally murdered 17 beautiful young lives in this area on Long Island alone. Think of it. They butchered those little girls. They kidnap, they extort, they rape, and they rob. They prey on children. They shouldn't be here.
The U.S. president also appeared to support police brutality in his remarks. He said, "Don't be nice," he told the officers. He decried the practice officers have of shielding the heads of handcuffed detainees. Sri Lanka has signed a $1.1 billion deal with a Chinese company to sell a majority stake in a controversial deep port in a bid to slash debt, and says it has addressed concerns that China could use support for military purposes. The deal was signed after months of renegotiation following strident opposition to the project, while critics at home warned that handing majority control to the Chinese threatens national security. Neighboring India fretted about China gaining access to a strategic port in its immediate neighborhood in the Indian Ocean. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga. Peter Clote has the day off.
What I was moved by was the incredible amount of warmth the Libyans have shown towards my modest personality.
The head of the UN support mission in Libya hails the support of Libyans.
Where you don't see trees, the soil disappears, the biodiversity disappears, the genetic diversity. But to soil and watersheds is the most important. When that disappears, everything starts breaking down.
Plans are underway to grow Africa's agribusiness and trade.
It was something that we had every single day. Things like McDonald's or KFC was the luxury that we'd have on a Friday night or Saturday evening for supper.
And we look at the South Africans' growing middle class and its impact on traditional foods and recipes. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. The newly appointed head of the UN support mission in Libya is set to arrive in the country soon. Veteran Lebanese diplomat and academic Ghassan Salame is in New York for talks with UN officials and ambassadors before heading to Libya next week. He was in Paris earlier this week for the signing of a declaration of two of Libya's political leaders, which the UN Security Council has welcomed. Mr. Salame told UN Radio's May Yakub that since the announcement of his appointment in June, he has received messages of support from the country's people.
What I was moved by was the incredible amount of warmth the Libyans have shown towards my modest personality. And I'm very grateful for a number of sentences I read. One of them said, if it's you, it means that the crisis is soon to be solved. Or if it's you, we know that we will find somebody who truly listens to our voice. I was moved by this. I'm sure that many of their predecessors have been listening to them. But to devote these sentences to my arrival was very moving.
We heard that you are staying for a few days here in New York. What are your plans in here?
Well, mostly meeting with those in the UN Secretariat who deal with Libya, in the Department of Political Affairs, in other departments as well, but also meeting with as many permanent representatives as possible. Mm. Because I would also have a refined view of how Libya is looked at, first by the P5 countries, but also by other countries who have a direct interest in the evolution of Libya. Countries such as Egypt, Algeria, Italy, who happen to be very close, Tunisia certainly, and a number of international organizations such as the EU or the African Union. So I will go to Libya, hopefully.
When exactly are you going?
In a few days. I hope to be in Libya by August the 4th or the 5th.
I have to ask you about a positive achievement. A few days ago in Paris, an agreement was reached. Of course, it was sponsored by the French President Emmanuel Macron. What is the most important points of this agreement and how it will reflect on the peace process?
Although I was present, I will not take credit for something that was not of my own making. It was the French who negotiated with both Sarraj and Haftar this communique. In this communique, there are a number of points, some of them extremely positive. The most positive of them is that both sides have agreed that the solution to the Libyan problem can only be political. and not military. Another point is that they are calling for an immediate ceasefire, but not against terrorists, which is understandable. They also agree, which is important for at least one of the two sides, that the LPA, the Libyan Political Accord, is the framework that needs to be respected, because there is no, presently at least, an alternative to it. And they also agree on having elections sometime next year, something that needs to be very well prepared.
Sure.
The UN will certainly help in that preparation. The UN does not observe elections, but the UN helps in trying to have free and fair elections. For that, we need time, we need preparation, and the Libyans themselves need to get ready, which means a much wider circle of consultation than the two personalities who met in Paris.
Dr. Ghassan Salami, what is your message now that you are traveling very soon to the Libyan people?
That I am coming to work with them and for them. I am not going to work in their place, because there are things they need to decide.
Mm-hmm.
If they are happy to remain in this vicious circle, political vicious circle, I can do nothing for them.
Mm-hmm.
But if their decision is to get out of it, they will find in me an energetic and creative mind at their service.
Ghassan Salami, the head of the UN support mission in Libya, speaking in New York with UN Radio's Amer Yacoub. Agriculture accounts for 65% of Africa's labor force and one-third of its gross domestic product, according to the World Bank. However, a high proportion of the continent's farmers produce only enough food for their own family and a meager surplus. For traditional subsistence farmers, knowing how to expand their business and gain access to markets can be a real challenge. In many countries, they are thwarted by the effects of climate change, including drought and famine, but there are sustainable new business opportunities for African farmers as well. Recently, a small conference at Rutgers University in New Jersey brought together investors, development experts, policymakers, and farmers dedicated to growing Africa's agribusiness and trade. VOA's Adam Phillips was there.
It's day three of the inaugural International Congress for African Agribusiness and Trade, and every one of the 150 or so people here has brought their own particular area of interest and expertise to the week-long event. Co-chairman Michael Hurley is Special Programs Director for the Bonobo Conservation Initiative, a nonprofit group based in Washington, D.C. and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Hurley has worked tirelessly to help Africa's farmers get the tools and technology they need to prosper, but in environmentally sustainable ways. For example, he discovered that in parts of Africa, a mosaic virus was killing off 80% of the cassava crop. Forest farmers would then chop down trees to clear land to grow enough cassavas to feed their families. But reckless deforestation degrades the soil and contributes to global warming.
Where you don't see trees, the soil disappears, the biodiversity disappears, the genetic diversity. But to soil and watersheds is the most important. When that disappears, everything starts breaking down.
Hurley helped introduce farmers to a strain of cassava that is resistant to mosaic virus. This strain of cassava produces the same yield on 15% of the land area. This means more cassava, which means more food and revenue, less deforestation, less greenhouse gas, and less global warming.
So agriculture was the greatest threat, but I also perceive that it could possibly be one of the greatest opportunities.
Congress participant Josh Doré helps farmers in a different way. As co-founder of Guinea's University for Community Development, Doré is here to seek funders to develop grassroots initiatives for farmers living on poverty's edge.
We are asking for partners for different projects, for agricultural production, community trade, research, agritourism, Agritourism allows people to come and visit and learn about products.
Such as, for example, that there are 15 varieties of turkey they can raise.
It gives the community a lot of different opportunities.
Keeping perishable produce stable long enough to bring it from farm to market is often a challenge in rural Africa, where infrastructure can be poor. That means waste for the public and poverty for farmers. Professor Mukun Karve, a Rutgers University food scientist, advocates a mechanical process that converts flour and raw material like cassava, maize, yucca, tapioca, and lentils into dry pasta for transport and sale.
You put it in a box and 6 months is still okay. And then you can be very innovative and make business out of it.
Gene Suffolk Giage is founder and CEO of Futures Agribusiness, based in Maryland. He's here looking for foreign investors for African agricultural projects which lead to the global marketplace. It is Giage's job to get the many various players together to make it work. That means producers, truckers, foreign investors, port workers, and crucially, government policymakers.
Exactly. But to be able to do that, government needs to agree with us that this is what we need to improve the livelihood of producers. And then when the government approves, they need to bring some facilities for us to operate. So we're working on that step by step. When it comes to the politics, there is no way to control.
Professor Carl Prey is an agricultural economist at Rutgers University's School of Environmental and Biological Sciences. He says African governments must strive to get modern technology to traditional farmers. This means funding technology research and easing unnecessary restrictions on genetically modified seeds and drought-resistant plant varieties that have already been tested and approved abroad.
It can be a virtuous cycle. They can make more money. They can then buy services and industrial products that create good jobs for everybody in the country. Our ultimate goal in our research is to help farmers be able to pull themselves out of poverty and out of hunger, because it feed more people within the country also. I mean, because it then allows country to grow in other sectors, the service sector and industrial sector, if you can produce enough internally.
Continued climate change, coupled with Africa's explosive population growth, make it certain that challenges will continue for Africa's farmers. Still, the participants at the inaugural International Congress for African Agribusiness and Trade do share this hope that innovation, hard work, and opportunity will help ensure a habitable, prosperous future for the continent. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New Brunswick, New Jersey.
People with albinism living in Tanzania continue to live in fear, particularly in the rural areas. A United Nations human rights expert has concluded after her first visit to the country. Iponwasa Iro is the UN independent expert on enjoyment of human rights by persons with albinism, made the remarks at the end of her 11-day visit to the country. Albinism, a genetic condition that is characterized by a complete lack of pigmentation, affects people worldwide regardless of their ethnicity or gender. UN Radio's Jocelyn Sambera reports.
Praising the government of Tanzania for tackling the issue, UN independent expert Iponwosa Ero welcomed on Friday the drop in the number of reported attacks against people with albinism. She warned, however, that the root causes of the attacks remain rampant and that the effects of over a decade of violations have taken their toll. The problem is rooted in the mistaken belief that the body parts of people with albinism have value in witchcraft practices, Ms. Ero said. The government and civil society have taken measures to address these practices, including the registration of traditional healers. However, the UN expert noted, confusion still exists in the mind of the general public between witchcraft practice and the work of traditional healers. Ms. Ero called on the authorities to continue to educate the public and strengthen protection measures for people with albinism. Jocelyn Sambira.
Still in East Africa, Kenya has officially recognized the Kenyan nationals of Asian descent as the country's 44th ethnic community. The move, while largely symbolic, reflects the historic and economic contributions of the Indian community in the East African country. Supporters in the community hope the group designation signals the start of greater political engagement. Rawel Omomboa reports for VOA from Nairobi.
Kenyans of South Asian descent, commonly referred to as Muindis in Kenya, are now the country's 44th tribe. Fred Matiang'i, Kenya's acting Minister of Interior, made the announcement July 21st on behalf of Kenya's president.
Now you are part and parcel of us formally. You are part and parcel of Kenya's great family. And we expect that we will continue this integration in all spheres of life, socially, culturally, economically, and actually, even in terms of participation in government and government processes.
India started coming into East Africa in the 17th century. The advent of colonial rule then expanded businesses and employment opportunities, including serving in the British Army in East Africa and building the Kenya-Uganda Railway. Shakil Shabir's father was among the thousands of Indian laborers who built the railway of a century ago. Shabir's family remained in Kenya, and the MP is now one of the four elected officials of Asian descent in Kenya. Shabir told VOA that while Indians have enjoyed economic success in Kenya for generations, many have remained on the sidelines politically. He hopes the tribal designation will change that.
You feel more comfortable now than you did before? Okay, maybe it was a cultural thing. Maybe you needed to be recognized. We have recognized you. Now what? It's a two-way job. You've been recognized by the system. Now we want you to now take your role in society.
The tribal designation recognizes Kenya of Asian descent who already have Kenya nationality, meaning their parents were born in Kenya. Farah Manzoor is a fifth-generation Kenyan of Indian descent. She's also an activist who spearheaded the quest for recognition beginning in 2010.
How it will help us, you know, like in the parliament even, okay, the Muindis have been there. But now we are a minority, okay, we are a tribe. We will be given allocations, okay, in Paris statutes. Not all of us, I'm not saying it should be given to all of us, but you will see Muindis now in government institutions.
While the tribal designation may raise the community's profile, it does not confer specific rights and privileges. Not everyone sees the point. Zahid Rajan is a writer and a member of the Kenya Asian Forum Steering Committee.
In terms of our rights and our participation, Kenyans as a whole have been marginalized. You know, the outcry in the body politic is that we want inclusivity in governance, you know, and in the running of our own life. That inclusivity right now does not exist because you've got dominance of one or two ethnic groups. I think to push for the rights of a minority community to seek special status is both wrong and divisive.
Critics see political calculation in the timing of the government's announcement. With hotly contested nationwide elections just weeks away, the community of Kenyans of Asian descent number in the tens of thousands. The latest census data from 2009 puts the total at just over 46,000. Kenya's decision has revived activism in the Indian community in neighboring Uganda. Activists there are reiterating the call they made to President Yoweri Museveni in 2014 to amend the constitution to make them Uganda's 66th tribe. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
Economic analysts say the number of black South Africans entering the country's middle class has swelled to about 6 million. The government's affirmative action policies have resulted in black people being employed in posts such as teaching and the civil service. Under apartheid, jobs like these were largely reserved for whites. Being more financially rewarded means many salaried black individuals have left the poor urban townships where they grew up for more affluent suburbs where only white people lived during racial segregation. However, many have also left their traditional foods and recipes behind in the townships. But as Darren Taylor reports for VOA, this is changing.
Ponso Pilane tucks into a coil of vors, beef and pork sausage flavored with spices, in a restaurant in Johannesburg. She writes about culture for South Africa's Mail and Guardian newspaper. Pilane was raised in a rural village where eating traditional food was the norm.
It was something that we had every single day. Things like McDonald's or KFC was the luxury that we'd have on a Friday night or Saturday evening for supper.
Her ethnicity is Botswana. Their staple food is a heavy brown sorghum porridge.
Usually before we cook the mabele pap, we let it ferment for about 1 or 2 days. So it has a bit of a sour aftertaste. And that we usually would have with boiled chicken.
Pilana and her family would also eat morojo, or wild spinach, and meat smothered in chakalaka.
Chakalaka is baked beans mixed with fried carrots and chilies.
Pilane watched with sadness in recent years as black South Africans' entry into the middle class sparked their mass consumption of fast food. And as they moved into better neighborhoods, so they began eating at expensive restaurants offering European-style cuisine. But now Pilane says she's noticing a desire among more of her middle-class compatriots to rediscover their culinary roots. And eateries once confined to the townships are moving into suburbs like Melville. Observing the trend, chefs recently opened the Grill Lounge here a few months ago. It serves only South African recipes, with not a burger or baguette in sight. Waitress Stephanie Boers delivers customers dishes like mokgodu.
Mokgodu is tripe, basically. It's
and that is the sheep's stomach?
Yes, either sheep or cow. We don't usually use a lot of spice in our traditional foods because it kills the flavor. So we just use water, salt, potatoes.
Another Xhosa delicacy she presents is manqina, or pig feet. Like the mokgodu, manqina is braised for hours until tender and enjoyed by local school teacher Sarah Tabane. She says she's happy she no longer has to drive to faraway townships to buy traditional food. Pilane says places like the Grill Lounge are evidence of South Africa's strengthening black economy and also of cultural development.
And it shows that's how culture becomes mainstream, when the people that belong to that culture are included in the mainstream economy, in the formal living arrangements, and in the bigger picture of society.
Yoda, can I have a sirloin, living salad, mushroom sauce, and mustard salad, please?
Steve Maresh calls an order in the kitchen of his steakhouse. Even restaurants like his, where millionaires dine, are now serving indigenous food. Maresh serves his expensive meat with pap, a stiff snow white maize porridge.
When we're doing something unusual, we'd add some creamed sweet corn to it and a herb and spice mix. But generally it's kept traditional but served with a very hearty, delicious tomato pepper relish.
But Pelane warns that some opportunists are gentrifying traditional recipes. She cites the township kota. That's a quarter loaf of bread filled with wors, drowned in a spicy tomato and onion sauce called achar.
I was shocked when I found out that there's a restaurant that opened, owned by white people, that sell kotas. But they don't sell it using the loaf of bread. They use fancy, really almost absurd stuff like ciabatta bread and all these.
But Pilane's enjoying the irony, as she puts it, of Western-style food being increasingly replaced by traditional recipes in South African diets. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. And coming up in the second half of the program, the Saturday Music Spot from our collection of music from across the continent. Yes, yes, yes. Now it's time for a Saturday Music Spot. Time to relax and enjoy great African music.
Colinga mi baila bato for town. Them say they waka waka. Talk talk. Sabi sabi. Like say now only you. Mr. Pognosa. Mama talk talk. Tika likunya na je ya bali Mutemo mabe Likundu na yo Sans esprit Bilo bela mwanza Kote sababu Korate babu Nizoka na yo Kukuni bakwiti na yo Nisenga senga Bibunda bunda Kufinga batue Komoni milangwa na yo Kikulula na yo Azua na yo Kimusenzi na yo Wepa Nga ina peki saki yo
Tika visa leli amabro tika
Nga ina peki saki yo
Tika visa leli amabro tika
Nga ina peki saki yo Nga ina peki saki yo Come and tell me, say, I'm here to make my baby.
tonight.
You wasn't me.
Everybody got around all the compass and I need to make them move tonight.
You wasn't me.
Oh yeah, baby, don't call police.
You wasn't me.
Grandmama, don't break the pot.
You wasn't me.
Party don't enter east to east.
You wasn't me.
Oh yeah, baby, scatter party plot.
You wasn't me.
See the matter, see the matter, baby, now you be the matter. See the matter, see the matter, Eri, now you be the matter. See the matter, see the matter, baby, now you be the matter. See the matter, baby.
Oh, let me be the one, baby. Can I tag along, baby? For you, I do this song, oh, baby. Can I be your bellema, be your bellema? My brain is just a pop, 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 tea. Pop, 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 tea, boys. My heart is just a pop, 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 tea.
Can call me, tell me, say, I'm here to make my baby tonight.
You wasn't me.
Everybody got around all the compass and I'm here to make them tonight.
You wasn't me.
Oh, yeah, baby, don't call police.
You wasn't me.
Grandmama, don't break the pot.
You wasn't me.
Party, don't enter east to east.
You wasn't me.
Oh, yeah, baby, scatter party.
You wasn't me. You wasn't me.
Africa lady, oh,
hi.
I sing in the song for Panya, and I dance in the dance for Panya, oh. I would do anything for Panya,
anything, yeah.
And I thank you the Lord for Panya, hey.
Oh, what is my baby name?
Baby,
I request for my baby girl.
Panya, panya, oh, panya.
Kenya scatter the fluff for me.
Nowhere to be, nowhere to be, nowhere to be. Shabu.
gigola kwanso timeless kana shaye monaco yeah yeah okundu bokoto simhaya mori uku mo konko techno la on lo ko duro ko wa pitana ko lo je celebo have I told you I'm feeling your body movement says you need somebody of a professionally be when body needs somebody and still left nobody that is to say I don't you need sumo miami where my for me bring sumo jackie lana si pe pelu kumo to ba fit to ba fe wa si I don't do gbogbo everyday you no go live on pension ọpọlọmọkùnrin jìnnà sapatẹsán ọmọlẹṣà ṣàyé ṣàyé ọlọwà mi ní màlẹ màlẹ ìyá ṣàlì mo tẹlẹ tẹlẹ síríkì orí ṣàyẹ ó fẹẹ sí ọlọtúnwá mi lámẹ ètò láìmí fọ gánà bí kwamẹ kwamẹ náà ni ó wà lè fi mi mo ti ń pàṣẹ pé kàn gbà bí ẹ má gbà bí kò bá gídé yá nà ọwọ yẹn sókè àwọn ọmọ orílẹ̀ nà ọwọ wọn sókè súrìlérè yá nà ọwọ yẹn sókè Mr. DJ Marco
My baby fine, oh, oh. siblings. Together we go to scatter the place. We go to grow our own family. As we're making money categorically. Oh no no. Baby, you capture my heart, oh baby.
Our Saturday music spot. I hope you sincere you enjoyed the music, and some more will be coming next week. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. From the rest of the Nightline team, we thank you for joining us tonight and hope to see you again tomorrow, Sunday. I'm Douglas Mpuga.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Swaziland has a problem. It has the world's highest prevalence of HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. According to UNAIDS, in 2016, 220,000 people out of a population of about 1.5 million were living with HIV, including 27.2% of all adults ages 15 to 49. Last year, 3,900 citizens of Swaziland died as a result of the HIV virus, and 8,800 were newly infected. In 2016, life expectancy for men was 52 years, 51 years for women. 10 years ago, the government of Swaziland made a commitment to stabilizing the epidemic with an eye to eventually reversing it. With the support of the U.S. government, through the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, the Ministry of Health and other partners expanded access to comprehensive HIV prevention, care, and treatment services for all persons living with HIV/AIDS. The effort has proven to be a success. On July 24th, PEPFAR issued groundbreaking data showing that the HIV epidemic is coming under control across all age groups in Swaziland. Additional PEPFAR-supported studies released in December 2016 show similar results in Malawi, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. The rate of new HIV infections in these countries has decreased by more than 50%, and in Swaziland by nearly half. Malawi, Swaziland, Zambia, and Zimbabwe are among the 13 highest burden countries where PEPFAR is accelerating its efforts toward reaching epidemic control by 2020 through the UNAIDS 90-90-90 framework and expansion of HIV prevention, while simultaneously sustaining support to all countries and populations where it works. We now have clear evidence that four African countries are approaching control of their HIV epidemics, said U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator and Special Representative for Global Health Diplomacy, Ambassador Deborah Birx, M.D. These unprecedented findings demonstrate the remarkable impact of the U.S. government's efforts through PEPFAR and the Global Fund to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria in partnership with African countries. We now have a historic opportunity to change the very course of the HIV pandemic.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.